cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We've been talking a lot about Tesla today with good reason. Stock's still, it's not 100% anymore. It's 98.33%, the gains this year.
Oh,
you know, should we not talk about it?
Well, it's still off of its highs from 2021.
That's a really good point. Some perspective. But it's been on a tear this year and it's on track for its record 11th consecutive session of gains. So it's also a longtime favorite among retail traders. So let's get into it because there's been some news, some fundamental just following on the heels of GM saying it's going to tap into Tesla's EV charging network following also after Ford did the same thing. So let's get to it with David Welch, Bloomberg News Detroit Bureau Chief. He is on the phone from Detroit. David, great to have you here with Matt and myself. So now it looks like, what, $3 billion that Tesla stands to gain by 2030 because of these deals with Ford and GM. How big a nut is that when you look at the revenue picture for Tesla?
I mean, at the end of the day, it's not huge revenue. I just think it's interesting because you look over the past 5 years and they've made over $5 billion selling regulatory credits to the legacy automakers who need to meet clean air standards and don't have enough electric vehicles to do it. So Tesla just, $3 billion by 2030, their revenue is over $80 billion a year now. It'll probably be much greater by then. So it's a few percentage points. It's not massive for a growth company like this. But to me, it just stands out that they keep making money off their competitors.
That's great.
Because they have such a lead in electrification that their competitors keep giving them ways to either money or directly or ways to make money to fund their new products while they're trying to catch up to Tesla in the first place.
So I have so many questions. I'm glad you could join us, David. Isn't this really cool in that it creates an industry standard, or is it global or is it just the U.S.?
Right now, it's just U.S. We'll see what happens globally. I think it'll stretch to Canada as well. There are Chinese automakers. I think they've got their own standard over there, but Tesla does sell EVs in that market. I'm not totally sure what the confluence of different standards is over there. But U.S. market, it is very cool that we're getting one standard because honestly, it was kind of dumb that we had more than one.
Yeah, it's stupid. It's like Betamax versus VHS. Like, right? Remember the old...
Right. That's a classic business case, And for that matter, the days when, and I was an Apple geek in the early days, when you started losing certain programs because it wasn't compatible with Windows or Microsoft products. So eventually, I think Steve Jobs caved and bridged the gap. But for a while, if you had Apple stuff, you couldn't use certain things.
So speaking of caving, is Stellantis next? Because I'm looking forward to Dodge is going to make a Charger EV that is just going to be insane. Is that going to have a Tesla-style charging port?
I bet it will. I mean, I think everybody has to cave at this point. You're talking about the number one, two, and three companies in EV sales in the U.S. I think Toyota will have to as well. And I think everyone is going to have to follow and do this. And so it's not, they're talking about an adapter to begin with and then eventually just making putting a Tesla inlet port. in the vehicle. It's not a radical change for anybody. It's, you know, it's not like they're, you know, going from a gasoline engine to a jet engine in the car. You know, this is a plug.
But it creates, like, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, whether you like Elon Musk or not, I mean, he can be kind of kooky. But having said that, is it just the possibility, though, of creating a significant, even more revenue stream for this company? We talked about $3 billion, but could it even be more in the future?
Well, so the forecast I used from Piper Sandler and other analysts had forecast out, they're kind of some a little more similar, a little less, but directionally similar. And I think Piper Sandler's forecast is looking at not just Ford and GM, but basically everybody going this way. And I think now that this has happened, everybody's going to have to. Right. Eventually, I think the next shoe to drop here, that could actually reduce the amount of revenue growth Tesla gets out of this. I think all, you know, this patchwork quilt of multiple EV charging players that are out there that GM, Ford, and everybody else has partnerships with,
yeah,
they're going to have to adopt Tesla standards.
Unbelievable.
NACS. And when that happens, then consumers will be able to use other networks that aren't Tesla's, but using the Tesla charge port. But, you know, there's an interim here and you know, medium long term where Tesla's going to be making money off of this on their dedicated chargers. And look, they could for a very long time to come, actually, because if you're driving around and your car can use a charge point charger anywhere, you see a Tesla one that's open, you're going to take it. And it's more reliable, too.
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff, as always. The ever-evolving world of Tesla and Elon Musk. David Welch, Detroit Bureau Chief at Bloomberg News, on the phone from Detroit. Really appreciate it. David, have a good
weekend. Thanks, David.
How are you? I mean, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, right? And just what this move. You were kind of like blown away.
Well, I think it's very cool because it creates... I always applaud kind of universal standards, even when they're not necessarily the best choice. For example, VHS... probably the technology wasn't as good as beta. For those of you old enough to remember what
beta
we're talking
about.
Beta
was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Or there was three quarter. Remember there's beta and three quarter
too? I remember
two?
All of them. But it doesn't matter. The point is when you get a universal standard, then the industry grows much faster. So for me, that's the exciting point about this. You know, we're already expecting 18% growth. Near to a fifth of all car sales globally this year are going to be EVs. So this is just going to accelerate that transition, which is exciting and also in some ways a concern, right? Because our grid maybe can't handle it if we have that many EVs.
Well, we found that yesterday, right? All the conversations we had about the energy markets and, you know, how old our grid is. Not a news story, everybody, but it just seems like we talk about the importance of infrastructure, you know, investing, whether it's energy or whether it's like EV, you know, charging areas. And we just kind of forget to do it. And so in this case, you have got a private sector company doing it.
I'm very pumped also about the next generation of EVs because I think it'll be the first generation of EVs from other automakers that are really from bottom up designed to be electric vehicles. So no longer just ICE vehicles that the company put a battery
in. What's ICE mean?
ICE, an internal combustion engine.
Got it.
So no longer just gas-burning vehicles that used to have an engine that they just put a battery in. So they're designed, purpose-built to be EVs, and they're going to be not only much better in terms of everything, from range to handling to performance.
Which is what what Tesla is, right?
Yeah, for sure. But they're also going to be much more affordable, which is what I'm looking forward to because, you know, you go out there in the market right now.
It's crazy.
And you see vehicles, like the BMW iX is really cool, but it's $90,000 to start. Now you're starting to see real competition. I'm driving right now a Nissan Ariya, I think it's called, Ariya. I'm test driving it and it's unbelievably cool. It's elegant in its design. It's fast. It handles well. It's fun to drive and it's affordable. It's like starts at 45 grand or something.
So kind of like the idea of when Prius was first, you know, created as a hybrid, was it thought about as from the ground up?
Well, that was, I'm sure, thought about as a ground-up hybrid vehicle, for sure.
Because if you look at it,
Tesla's, you're right, we're ground-up designed to be EVs after the Roadster. Because remember, the Roadster they first used was actually, a Lotus or an Opel body, and they put a battery in it.
This is why we love having you around. You kind of know a few things.
I know a few. You know a few things too.
No, but I'm with you. I'm looking at the prices on things and I'm like, what happened? Am I missing
too
something?
Expensive.
I mean, this is, how do you make this a mass market car if we're supposed to, you know, ramp up to hit certain
it's
targets?
Coming.
All right. I'm going to hold my breath and can't wait.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We know a lot of news on crypto this week, to say the least, Matt. U.S. really feel like it's being thrown into deeper array. You had also Binance today. Banking partners getting ready to rescind support. Liquidity drying up. Traders withdrawing tokens from the platform as regulators are clamping down on the company and its owners. So it's been a week full of some really tough news for the crypto universe.
Yeah, absolutely. The Coinbase move probably felt more by U.S. investors, obviously, because it's publicly traded here. But Binance is the big cat in this industry. And if it starts to lose, I guess, scale, that's a problem for advancement in this in crypto.
It does wonder about kind of this latest stress points and the viability of the U.S. crypto industry. So let's get into it with Solidus Labs Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, Kathy Kraninger, also former Director of the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, joining us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. once again. Solidus is a crypto market surveillance and risk monitoring platform, just for those of you not in the know. Kathy, good to have you back with us. Your gut take on the news this week and what it means for the U.S. crypto industry.
Well, you said it here too. It is quite a week when you thought the news couldn't get any bigger. we find ourselves continually on a roller coaster with this industry and unfortunately, particularly in the U.S. Look, I've said it before. Agencies should go after bad actors. That's exactly what you want to see happen. So there are certainly some allegations that Binance needs to address. And having that out in the open, frankly, gives them the opportunity to do that. No surprise, the SEC has been engaging in investigations into a number of platforms and operators in the crypto space now for quite some time. So having the cases out there and in the open matters. The other side, as you mentioned with Coinbase, they're two very different cases.
So what? Let's focus in on Coinbase in terms of what they can do. Well, really, the similarity, I think, between the two is compliance is almost impossible for crypto businesses, or that's what they tell us. Is that true? You know, because we hear Gensler say, all we want you to do is come into compliance. And these crypto businesses say, there's no way for us to do that. We've applied and they rejected us.
There are some real challenges here around the definitions and the requirements, definitely. So, and actually a great hearing on Tuesday that included a Coinbase witness, as Chairman Thompson of the House Agriculture Committee noted, highly unusual to have a witness before the committee who's now the subject of an enforcement action and litigation by an agency, but that was par for the course and why the hearing was so important and the legislation was so important. So, It is challenging, no doubt. There are very few crypto businesses or special purpose registrations that have gone through that are related to crypto. And part of that has to do with, too, you know, the business that they are engaged in and the fundamental disclosures, requirements, and registration nuts and bolts that the SEC requires that they just simply cannot actually comply with. Some of it also is related to what the nature of these assets are and having that be clear in law. Coinbase is a publicly traded company. They go through a rigorous process that they have outlined repeatedly around their assessment of which assets are or are not securities. And it is not their intention to list securities, as many of the platforms say. So why they would be subject to registration is something that, again, this case now is going to really be at the heart of the matter of. Are these assets securities and why? And the SEC actually, you know, asserting that and proving that.
What's your take, by the way? I mean, people always talk about the Howey test. And there are some cases in which it's very clear And I think Gary Gensler has said himself there are some cases in which it's, you know, Bitcoin, for example, is not a security. But in a lot of these instances, you can debate whether it's a security or a commodity.
You definitely can. I mean, it comes down to, again, whether there is an aspect of decentralization in terms of whether this is, you know, that group of people that you expect to benefit from and reap the rewards of their work and their, you know, their efforts. So that is one prong of the analysis, certainly under the Howey test that gets some attention. And there are certainly things like Bitcoin that you would argue is decentralized. I think there is some real question too over what ownership aspect there really is and what anyone actually owns. And so the other dynamic here in terms of what securities law requires, that takes me back to the first question you asked of what is important here. It is important for issuers and listers to actually disclose what the asset does, what it's intended to do, how it's used, who's behind it. There are some classic things that, again, good actors in crypto claim they're already doing and meeting. So in some respects, meeting the spirit of that important information and getting it to investors. But all the mechanics of registration are things that they simply cannot actually meet.
So Kathy, you know, we had a conversation, Matt and I, yesterday with former SEC Chair Jay Clayton, and Dan Moorhead, also, who's very involved in the crypto space. And I do wonder, one of the points that came up is that you do already see sovereign, you know, being issued based on blockchain technology around the world. And I do wonder, you know, as we think about the legitimacy of crypto going forward, has kind of the train left the station? And so that if the U.S. is not on board in terms of figuring out the regulatory framework, along with other folks, in the world, that they will be ultimately left behind. Can we make that conclusion if they're not involved, if the U.S. isn't involved, U.S. regulators?
Look, I agree with that in part. I would say the U.S. markets are such that, you know, there will always be an interest by companies to serve U.S. markets, and that will come back around. I think where it really does concern me is the national security dynamics. We have benefited from decades and even, I suppose, more than a century of U.S. innovation setting the standard for how the globe operates. We built the financial systems of the world. So there is a national security benefit to that. The dollar being, you know, basically the world's currency, we benefited from that. And the notion that we would be absent as the next financial system is really being built and that infrastructure is being built, that's where we're really, I think, losing that long-term competitive advantage and our place in the world's economy and then, frankly, in the global dynamics, even politically speaking, and from a stability standpoint and a national security standpoint. So that does concern me greatly, and I think is hugely unfortunate if we just concede. The other thing I would note that is so different this year is really Chair Gensler's statement and attitude when you get to, you know, what is there room for in this new economy, and his stance that the only digital currencies that are necessary are the ones that already exist and are issued by governments. You know, that really does undermine the potential and opportunity that's here. But some of it gets to terminology too. I've not really believed that the future of a lot of the tokenization is truly in currency, you know, and really replacing sovereign currencies. But there is, I think, a lot with the infrastructure that having, you know, stable coins and certainly having digital assets is hugely beneficial.
Do you think there's a consensus feeling in Congress about which way we need to go in terms of either supporting it or killing it?
I continue to believe that on both sides of the aisle, there's a lot of interest in setting this up the right way and understanding the potential and having the conversation. A lot of concern, frankly, about the scams and fraud and dynamics around FTX that's completely legitimate. I mean, look, whenever any new technology comes into play, there are going to be those challenges. And that's, I think, hugely unfortunate and where the industry needs to step up, calling out the bad actors, where agencies should focus their energy going after them. But where there are not clear rules that good actors can follow, yeah, that's really where you see the flight that we are, certainly people are asserting leaving the U.S. markets, and we're seeing some of that at softness.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Kathy, thank you. Appreciate you weighing in on all of this. Kathy Kroninger, Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at Solidus Labs, former Director of the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, joining us on Zoom from Washington, D.C. Matt, did you see the story about Robinhood removing three tokens from its crypto trading platform?
You know, so I think anyone's going to be doing that. If they've been defined as a security by the SEC, you got to get rid of them.
Right, they've got to be nervous.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Gotta love when we've got a guest coming on and we've got a question ahead of them even joining us.
A listener writes in with a question before we have the guest. That's brilliant.
That's how popular it is.
So they should always do that. It makes our lives so much easier.
Is everybody listening? Because please do this. Do this. Anyway, let's get right to it. Dr. Ian Lusbader is with us, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone on Zoom in New York City. Ian, good to have you back here and joining Matt and me on this Friday. Hope you're doing well. What's the week been like you based on the air quality and what we had to deal with this week?
You know, I think everyone's been concerned about the wildfires in Canada. Hard to believe, 700 or 800 miles away. I've been a native New Yorker for all my life. I've never seen fires in Canada cause the air pollution that we saw over the last few days throughout the Northeast. And we've had a lot of calls from patients with COPD and emphysema. It's been a real challenge. We've had to raise people's medications, inhalers. And I think there's also this anxiety on top of COVID anxiety and on top of all sorts of anxiety that they're vulnerable, that there's really no safe place to go. There's still some indoor air pollution and going out on the street, there's a lot of coughing, this acrid smell. And so there are real concerns, and also not only short-term, but long-term concerns, because smoke has, you know, hundreds of chemicals, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, particle size, large particles, small particles, really all smoke, but especially wood, organic chemicals, things like toluene and xylene, sulfur dioxide. And some of these over a long period of time can have, you know, risks, as you know, potential cancer risks. So it's been a problem for the patients and for the doctors.
So this leads well into the question that our viewer, our listener has, wondering about the everyday health effects of pollution from cars and buildings. You know, if you're walking around New York City, you're going to smell a lot of weed. There's smoke everywhere. What can we do, this listener wants to know, if we're living in the city or near the city to protect ourselves? Is it just masks, air filters? Is there anything else?
Well, certainly, you know, the N95 masks, certainly for people with lung disease, or if you can get one, is very helpful, right? So some of these particles, you've got large particles that generally the cilia in the nose and the nose hairs and sinuses can filter out. Some particles, the lung has these little hair cells called cilia. But for the very fine particles, we're talking, you know, under a micron, you know, in size, those can go deep in the lungs and cause a lot of problems. So the N95 masks, if you're outside during a day, like over the past few days, doing an air filter or air purifier in your apartment or in your office is very smart. Air conditioning that doesn't draw outside air in, you're not doing anything helpful if you're just sucking outside air in. You just have the air conditioner filter, but inside air, if it's refiltered, would be helpful. In general, you know, you're right. The city has a lot of particulate material from cars, buildings, smokestacks. So the air is always dirtier in a city than in the suburbs. Walking around the streets, you know, don't go behind a bus. A lot of the buses are electric now. The subways, those subway tracks, cause a lot of particulate material. If you look at the lungs, the autopsy of people who live in the city, they look much worse, all these dark particles compared to the suburbs. Living in the city, you have intrinsically higher risk. You can wear a mask outside. It's hard for most people to do that. That probably would help a bit, and use an air filter and air purifier in your office and in your home.
I have to say, you know, I've continued wearing a mask even post-COVID. Just especially in and around the subway, because I didn't even wear one during COVID. I'm very
although I understand that there are health benefits, and it may not have been the smartest move on my part. I just don't like to wear a mask, you know.
I don't know. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, no, people have psychologic issues, and it is hard to wear for long periods of time. You know, by and large, the air quality in New York is not terrible. They grade it really as sort of low, medium, and high, under 50, 50 to 100, and over 100. So it was well over 100 during the bad days. And I would say for that, wear a mask. I wore a mask when I left the office, you know, an N95. Most times in the city, the air quality is not that bad because of the changes. But certainly if you're near a smoky area or if you have lung problems, I would play it safe. And even getting a surgical mask can help. Cloth masks are useless, bandanas, that kind of thing. They didn't help with COVID. The, you know, viral particles went right through those. But investing in a good either respirator mask or N95, who knows in the future what other problems there may be. New York was not really prepared for this.
Right.
You know, we've never seen it. And I think we need to get prepared for other issues. You know, there are homeless on the street, and we have a lot of people who are vulnerable. And we need to plan for the future, whether it's storms or whether it's air issues.
Hey, Dr. Lespeter, one thing I did want to ask you, what are the consequences for folks that, you know, even if they're healthy in their lungs, just a few days of breathing in the air this week, or if we continue to have, you know, climate related or other, you know, fires and winds that are going to affect us?
You'll be fine.
We have more days like this in New York City. What do we need to be concerned about the long-term impact?
Well, you know, we don't really know. Look, any smoke exposure has some risk. And if you have lung disease or you've had a past history of smoking, you're at much higher risk. We do speak to your pulmonologist or general internist. We do screen with CAT scans. By and large, temporary smoke exposure we can get over. So most healthy people, the lungs can cleanse themselves to a degree. Particles can be put out. But for prolonged exposure, or if you have industrial exposure, higher risk of lung cancer, and you do need to touch base with your pulmonary specialist. Certainly people who have inhalers, sometimes we increase the dose of those. I would say try and get out of the city and get some clean air as much as you can to balance out your overall exposure. Go to the beach, get some clean air. Obviously in the winter, that's harder to do.
Right.
But I would definitely try and leave the city.
I have a really important question. Is there any help for Matt Miller? I just want to know, Ian.
It's a psychological thing. That's not your specialty, right?
Matt's great. I love his attitude. It's key. Next time we should speak about a new vitamin study that's out that talks about vitamins and dementia, multivitamins, There's some conflicting data about that, but maybe we can talk about that another time. I think it's fascinating. For a long time, we really said multivitamins don't help.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of evidence maybe they do.
That's cool. Fascinating. Well, that's what we call a deep tease, and you did it well. You're going to be back, I know, at a future date. Dr. Ian Lusbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone Center here in New York City.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Friday trade as well as the week. Carol Masser along with Matt Miller live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals. I want to get right to our guest because I'm curious, Matt, what Sam Stovall has to say about that 20% move off of that October 2022 low on the S&P 500. Sam, of course, is Chief Investment Strategist at CFRA on Zoom in New York City, somebody you and I have been talking to for years. Sam, it is
good
nice
couple
to have
of decades.
You here. I know. And I think it's a good thing. It means we've all seen a lot of cycles. What do you make of this cycle and this move off the bottom for the S&P 500 specifically? Let's start there.
Sure. Well, hey, Carol, good to talk to you again. Matt, always good to talk to you, especially with the new beard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that we registered that 20% advance, and now obviously people are wondering, will the market be like the messenger from Marathon who then stumbles and dies shortly after announcing the news? Or will it have legs to run further? And I think history basically tells us that we have further to go and that following 20% advances off of prior bear market lows, we typically advance about 14.5% and do so over a five-month period. So I would advise not selling too quickly into this rally, at least if you are a longer term investor, because chances are we have a ways to go.
Hang on. Sam Stovall, for those listening who don't know, has like more data than the Bloomberg.
Yep.
So when we hear about bear market rallies, and I've seen a number myself in the past couple of decades, but how often do you see a bear market rally that gets up to a more than 20% gain from the bottom and then it fizzles out?
Well, if you're looking at the NASDAQ, because it's much more volatile than the S&P, we've had 8 bear markets since the NASDAQ 100 was created in the late 1980s, and a full half of them experienced what I call bogus bottoms or fake outs, where the index was up by 20% only to turn around and set an even lower low. For the S&P 500, however, we have only had 3 such fake outs, and all 3 of them were confined to the 2 mega meltdowns of 2002 through 2002, as well as 2007 through 2009. This bear market I regard as a garden variety bear market, meaning less than 40% decline. And we have never had a bogus bottom occur within a garden variety bull market.
Nice. Yeah, because I was reading Savita Subramanian from Bank America. She said 92% of the time on the S&P 500, after you get to a 20% rally from the bottom, you have gains 12 months later. So, right. In other words, it's not a fake out.
Exactly. And actually, the only thing that I think investors are sort of worried that there could be some fake out is, why is it that this time around small caps are not leading the way as they have done five or six of the prior times going back to 1980 for the Russell 2000? This time around, we're up only about 11% versus the 21% for the S&P 500. So yeah, investors are sort of scratching their heads. What's different this time?
Well, what's different maybe this time, and there's another story on the Bloomberg talking about the disconnect between stocks and bonds, suggesting a 20% downside risk for equities if bonds are right in pricing inflation volatility. This is according to some modeling by JP Morgan Chase and company strategists. So if you look at kind of the bond market trade in terms of where, I guess, yields are staying and there are concerns about inflation volatility, if that continues to be persistent, Sam, is it potentially different time around? We've just come off several days of Bloomberg Invest, you know, top voices like yourself in the investment community talking about the markets and saying this is unusual times. We're coming off unprecedented amount of money that was pumped into the economy, because the global economy, because of the pandemic. We're not really quite sure how it plays out.
Right. Well, the good news is last Monday, I published a report called Hike, Skip, and a Jump. And what it showed was that going back to the beginning of when the Fed actually announced Fed fund changes, prior to that, they announced only discount rate changes, that whenever we did have that skip in the subsequent 8 weeks, meaning between those two FOMC meetings, the market was up 88% of the time, rising about 3.6% on average. So the good news is that if the Fed does indeed skip, as Fed funds futures are pointing to, that would be a positive sign. However, if the Fed basically either continues to raise or tells us that no, we're nowhere near being done, then, you know, they could end up not only strangling this new bull market, but could throw the economy into something much deeper than the mild recession currently priced in.
Sam, I'm interested to know how you compare and contrast this inflationary environment and the Fed hikes that we've seen with that of the 70s and 80s. You know, it seems Powell doesn't want to be an Arthur Burns. Are there parallels?
Well, certainly, I think by hearing hearing Jerome Powell say that he does not want to repeat the mistakes of the 1970s, that would imply that they are going to be raising rates longer. But at the same time, if you take a look at the inflation numbers, we're going to be getting CPI soon, next right. week. We're going to be getting CPI. Both of them continue to show a stair step down. And we're finding that the Fed funds rate is now well above both of those year-on-year changes. So that typically is what happens close to the end of a rate tightening cycle. And again, I point to what happens after the Fed stops raising rate. Historically, they don't cut rates for another 9 months. So
right.
my belief is they're not going to be cutting rates until the second quarter of next year. But still, the market is up 13% on average with all sizes, styles, sectors, and 99% of sub-industries in positive territory over that time frame.
So really quickly, 30 seconds, though, would you like to see a more broadening out, though, of the market trade?
Well, you could say that it is fairly broad already, because more than 50% of the stocks in the S&P 500 are positive year to date. 47% of them are above the markets, the S&P 500 equal weight performance. And a majority of certainly the high growth areas are showing percentages above 50. But even a group like real estate has 43% of its components in positive territory this year.
Okay. Gonna leave it on that note. Love the data points. You're right. I think it does have more than Bloomberg.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Sam.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.